Well, today we are talking about the Song of the Sea. Last time we did Exodus, and I think we covered like 13 and 14, and we talked about the parting of the Red Sea. And I don't know if we mentioned this, we may have, but this is just a good memory to kind of get our bearings back. The Promised Land is over here on one side, and Israel's here. And to get to the Promised Land, they have to cross the Yam Suf. Yam is the word for sea. And Yam is also a Canaanite god of chaos and the sea. And so the sea as a symbol of chaos is a very important motif because of Section 8 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And I don't know if we mentioned this. So if you go to Section 8 of the Law of Doctrine and Covenants, look what it says. Look at verse 2 and 3. Alyssa, when you get there, will you read D&C 8, verse 2 and 3 for us?
D&C 8, 2 and 3?
Yes.
Yea, behold, I will tell you in your mind and in your heart by the Holy Ghost, which shall come upon you and which shall dwell in your heart. Now behold, this is the spirit of revelation. Behold, this is the spirit by which Moses brought the children of Israel through the Red Sea.
I really like this. Welcome, Bailey. For a couple of reasons, I think this is really good. Section 8, verse 2, the Lord says, this is the spirit by which we get revelation. In other words, like I certainly wasn't there, but I think what we can read here is this. Moses is led, but when he gets here, I don't think he necessarily knows what he's, you know, what's going to happen. And we read in the 14th chapter of Exodus that everybody's complaining. They're like, Moses, you're going to kill us. This is the end of the world. This is the worst parade of horribles. Why do we follow you? And then I love this verse where God says this to, through him, where he speaks these words. Look in Exodus 14, 13. Right in the middle of the verse, Moses said, fear not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord. And then he raises the staff, and then the ocean parts. It's pretty awesome. And what does this have to do with you? I think this whole story is your life. See, this is you. And this is your chaos. And I like to call it school. Right? School and marriage and dating. And by the way, when you get married and when you get done with school, does the chaos really end? No. Because then there's other things. In other words, this is a great symbol for the mortal experience. And the spirit of revelation, to me, the spirit of revelation to me is that God is telling Moses, you go and you move, and as you move, you will get revelation. But I don't think God told Moses everything back over here. It just happens as he's on the move. In fact, Elder Oak said this. He says, so many of our revelations come to the saints when they're on the move, doing the things they need to be doing. So that's important. I'm a big fan of that. Okay, Song of the Sea. So they part the sea. What is the Song of the Sea? Well, let's read it. Let's read some of it. Now, here's my contention. There's really going to be two parts in it. So if you look in verse 1, it says Moses sang and the children of Israel, like he's singing. And then later, if you go to verse 20, it says that Miriam the prophetess, and she's the sister of Aaron, she takes the timbrel in her hand and all the women, and then they do their part. Now, this is a lot to unpack. There's this really cool website called thetorah.com. But in scholarship, the notion is essentially this, that the entire 15th chapter is one of the oldest pieces of literature in the Bible, probably the oldest text, and the entire thing is Miriam's Song of the Sea. That it's not Moses. A later redactor takes that and says, well, we're going to give Moses a part and we're going to give Miriam a part. Now, frankly, I don't care. If I had to pick one side, I would say this is entirely Miriam's song. And so in scholarship, a lot of times they call it Miriam's Song of the Sea. If you want to go down those rabbit holes, I have the website right here. You can just Google Carol Myers, Miriam's Song of the Sea, a women's victory performance. The image of a woman with a timbrel singing and dancing is rooted archaeologically with the temple. and it's been lost to us over time and through the apostasy. And so what I want to do is kind of look at this through the lens of First Israelite Temple and see it also as the women's part in this great victory of God conquering the sea. Anyway, so there's a lot in here. There's some good stuff to look at. So let's start. Let's just read a little bit. Let's read 1 through... Goodness. Let's do 1 through 12. Is that okay? So Bailey, are you okay to do the first 6?
Yeah,
15. Yeah, of chapter 15, and then 7 through 12. And then Sarah, I'm going to pick on you to do, if this is okay, 20 through 25. But we're going to do 1 through 12 first. Chapter 15.
Sing Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider have been thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war, the Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his host hath he cast into the sea. His chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea. The depths have covered them, they sink into the bottoms of stone. Thy right hand, O Lord, is become glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, hath dashed in pieces the enemy.
And in the greatness of thine excellency, thou hast overthrown them that rose up against thee. Thou sendest forth thy wrath, which consumed them as stubble. And with the blast of thy nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The floods stood upright as in heat, and the depths were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My lust shall be satisfied upon them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them. Thou didst blow with thy wind, the sea covered them. They sang as lead in the mighty waters. Who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? Thou stretchest out thy right hand, the earth swallowed them.
Okay, before we go on, notice verse 11. Do you see Manolatry right there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another classic text of Manolatry, is Psalm 95. So I'm just going to read that. Psalm 95, verses 1 through 3, reads as follows. Once I get it. Come, let us sing unto the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Come, let us come before his presence with thanksgiving and make a joyful noise unto him with psalms. The Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. So he's above all of the gods in this text. That's who he is. He's in charge. So they sing to him. And then what's really interesting is, look at what it says in verse 14 and 15. The people shall hear and be afraid. Sorrow shall take hold on them of Palestina. And the dukes of Edom shall be amazed. The mighty men of Moab, trembling, shall take hold upon them. And all the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. Now in scholarship, just be aware that 14 and 15 are considered markers and insertions. What I mean by markers and insertions is this. It's a marker as to when this was written, and the marker is we're back to the monarchy again. Why? Well, those kingdoms and those things didn't exist at this time, but they do later. So they're therefore inserted. Now, what I mean by that is this. I think this whole thing was performed and it was oral. If you study a lot of ancient texts, for example, like the Odyssey and the Iliad by Homer, the contention in these texts are that these were, in the Greek, they have this specific rhythm and rhyme. And the reason they did is because they were performed and they were oral. And then many hundreds of years later, after their performances, they were textualized, if this is making sense. And so we see this here in this text, that this is probably a performance. So let's get to Miriam. Verse 20, Sarah. And what did I give you? Was it 20 through?
25.
Okay, go ahead.
Miriam answered them, sing ye to the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, which when he cast into the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he created them.
Okay. So notice verse 20. Miriam comes, and her sister, the sister of Aaron, and all the women with dances, and they're singing, and they have timbrels. And then notice verse 25. There's this tree involved, this tree that does this healing of the water. Now, the symbol of the water and the tree is really, really old. The original First Israelite temple we've talked about has a tree in it. I think we've talked about this. And there's a fountain of waters that symbolically or mythically comes from under the rock, the foundation stone, and touches the tree and then waters the land. We see this in Ezekiel. When we get to Ezekiel, we'll see this, where Ezekiel sees the valley of dry bones. It rises up. The two sticks gather Israel. And then the 38th and 39th chapter, after Israel's been gathered, is the destruction of the earth through this massive war. And then from chapter 40 in Ezekiel to the end, Ezekiel sees the temple, and every chapter he gets closer. And the water starts at his tippy toes, and then he walks and it hits his ankles. And then it hits his knees, and then his loins, and then his chest. And then he says, then the river was so deep as it was wont to swim in. And then he comes into the temple. And so the idea is that the temple has this water coming out of it, this like a mythic spring. So we see all this here, shadows of all this imagery here, right in the text with Miriam. Now cross-reference verse 20 with this verse. I'm going to write it on the board. Psalm 68, 21 through 35.
Psalm 68.
Psalm 68, 21 through 35. Okay. And we're going to kind of back up. We're going to relax our eyes a little bit. And we're going to look at this story through the lens of the temple and see some of the women's parts. And just remember that the book of Psalms has in it embedded temple worship. One of the first guys to notice this was a Norwegian scholar, and his name is Sigmund Mowinkel. I'm going to write his name on the board. He's kind of a big deal in scholarship. He's not a member of the church. I think if he became one, I think it's C-K-E-L. If he became one, he would be blown away with what happens in our temples, and he would say, yeah, this is happening in the Psalms. So what's happening? Well, first of all, go to Psalm 68. Take a look at verse 25. What do you see? Isn't that interesting? Singers. And then when you put it in context, what they're singing, stuff starts to pop. So just look at some of these things. Look at verse 8, middle of the verse. Notice what's moving. Sinai is moving, right? The mountain of Moses. We're going to, verse 4, sing praises unto God. We're going to, verse 25, the damsels are going to be playing with timbrels. Look at verse 31. Princes, or kings and queens, are going to come out of Egypt. The Israelites are coming out of Egypt. And then look at verse 32. Bailey, if you have, do you have it?
Yeah, I do. Psalm 68.
Yeah, will you read it? Will you read 32 through 35?
Sing unto God, ye kingdoms of the earth, O sing praises unto the Lord, Selah. To him that rideth upon the heavens of heavens, which were of old, though he hath sent out his voice, and that a mighty voice. Ascribe ye strength unto God, his excellencies over Israel, and his strength is in the clouds. O God, thou art terrible, art of thy holy places. The God of Israel is he that giveth strength and power unto his people. Blessed be God.
Okay. So there's singing, and there's dancing, and we're conquering some things. Now, there's a lot going on in 68, especially if you get into the word Bashan and what that means. So this is kind of heavy, but I mean, look at verse 21. God is going to wound the head of his enemies. So we're going to kill the snake. What is the drama? I have a brief outline here. This is 700 pages of text boiled down to one slide. So I had to do some serious editing. I had 700 pages. In his book, Who Shall Ascend to the Hill of the Lord? LeGrand Baker and Stephen Ricks write all about the early temple drama as we read about in all these different cultures. And it was typically a 7 or an 8, depends on who you read, day event. The first 3 days was devoted to the beginning of the drama, the pre-earth life, missions assigned to the king and queen, and ritually to certain members of the divine council. And we would be audience members, but we would be vicarious in the ordinance, if I'm making any sense. What I mean by vicarious is, as the king and queen made covenants with God, they would represent like the mortal experience. We would be told, hey, they represent you. And so I've talked about this before, but it's kind of like, I'm going to draw a little picture on the board, might make more sense. So there's a stage. And this, by the way, this is the beginning of all drama in Greece. All drama in Greece was centered around the threshing floor. The stage was the threshing floor. And so what they did was they built these tiers, and you and me would sit here around, we'd bring our family and so forth, and we'd watch this drama played out. Now I'm just going to draw like a stage and like a curtain and those kinds of things. And by the way, if you think about like when I went to movies as a kid, they'd actually have the curtain, right? And then you'd see the show, right? Now, I don't know if they had curtains, but just work with me here. There'd be members that would walk out on the stage and they would have parts. And this is the beginning of drama. And then to the Israelites right here, this was a temple setting, there'd be an altar. And that altar, a king and his wife would come to the altar and they would make covenants with God. So there'd be somebody here representing God. And then they would turn and face the audience and the king would say, or the divinity here would say, as the king, there's his crown, and the queen have made covenants to me, so you, through him, vicariously have done the same thing. Am I making sense? This is all happening. Now, huh?
I said, wow.
Yeah. Now, the king, during the course of this event, would be indicative of the heavenly king. So we have these divine beings in heaven. We have Asherah, which is the spouse of El Elyon, the husband. And we have Yahweh. Yahweh is the prince. So the early teaching was that Yahweh would take upon him flesh, die, and be resurrected. And so in the drama, the king would be ritually stripped of his regalia. He would be slapped. They do this in Babylon. If you've ever read Jesus where he says, turn the other cheek, we think this is coming out of these ancient dramas, where the king would kneel, he'd be bound. And a person representing like the forces of chaos, he'd like the Yam character, and he'd be dressed in like all kinds of black stuff, and he'd slap the king. And then the king had to turn the other cheek, and then he'd slap him here. And this is in Egypt too, called the Sed Festival. And they'd slap him, and then they'd beat him. This is all like dramatic. It's not, they're not really killing the king. And then they would kill the king. Okay? So that's the king's combat with chaos and death. That's the first 3 days. At the end of this, this is the end of Act 1, or the middle of Act 2, kind of how you, depends on how you slice it. Now in my nerdiness, I'm going to be nerdy with you. This is kind of like Star Wars. Star Wars, we get the beginning of the drama. We see who the missions are. We see Luke's the good guy. Darth Vader's the bad guy. We see the creation of this empire and how it works. And it kind of ends with the king fighting chaos. Well, who's the chaos dragon in Star Wars? It's Darth Vader, right? And Luke gets his hand cut off, and Han Solo gets captured, and he gets taken to the bounty hunter. And you kind of end this with like, what's going to happen? Oh, no. And so then we get to day 4. Day 4, 5, and 6, while the king remains in the world of the dead, think of like Han Solo, like he's frozen in carbonite, right? We're mixing all these myths in Star Wars. The drama focused on the life and atonement of the Savior. So they do some teaching about the death of Christ, the death of Yahweh, as it were. By the way, the whole Book of Mormon's doing this on like almost every page. Then on his mission among the dead, and then finally on his resurrection, and then on day 7, Jehovah, now he's going to be represented by the Ark of the Covenant, or I'm going to contend he's also being represented by the King coming back to life. And there it is, the rescued king. They emerge from the underworld. They're joined by the people in a grand procession around the city. They would actually go, if this is the city, they would circumambulate the whole city. And by the way, there'd be a parade. The ark would be at the front. So here's the Ark of the Covenant, the king and the queen here, all the priests, and then all the people, and then we would participate and we'd go around the city. Now think about, this was at the new year. We do it too. We just call it this. We call it a parade. And one of the meanings of the word parade is to go around. Have you ever heard the phrase parade around? They're almost synonymous. They would parade around the city and celebrate the victory of Yahweh over death. So then they would celebrate the crowning victory of the drama, which was where the king and queen were crowned, they're anointed. And then on day 8, it concluded with a day of sacrificing, feasting, and rejoicing. That was the end. And they would eat a lot, and it would be the fulfillment of Jehovah's covenants with them and the ushering in of the millennial reign. Any questions so far? This is, like I said, 700 pages crammed into one slide, but I want to make sure we're kind of getting this. So you might be sitting here going, what does this have to do with the women's part, right? What is this? What's the point? Well, oh, thank you for your... Remind me later. Thank you. Okay, well... Go to section 45 of the Doctrine, or not the Doctrine and Covenants, go to section 45 of the Psalms. Excuse me. One of the things that we think is going on with this experience is that this story of fighting the sea is the battle against chaos. In other words, Yam, or the sea, is another name for the devil. In fact, to the ancient Near Eastern people, Yam also represented the forces of death. So what does Jesus do to the forces of death? He must kill them. The personification of Yam, sometimes it's called Tiamat, would be a dragon. So God's going to kill the dragon. So over and over again in the Psalms, we read that God's doing battle with the sea, or God's doing battle with Yam. In fact, before we do 45, really quick, just to, so you can kind of see this, go to the 74th Psalm. Sorry, we're bouncing around, but we'll get back to Exodus in a minute. This is all related. All of this mythic material is tied into the Psalms. Okay, 74. I'm going to have to use my paper scriptures, I think. Well, that's okay. Go to verse 13, Sarah. Will you read that? Will you read 13 through 14?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters. Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gavest him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness.
Do you see remnants of the parting of the sea with the dragon kind of mixed? Can you see the metaphors being mixed? Right? Mm-hmm. The God is the king in verse 12. He divides the sea and breaks the head of the dragon, and then kills it, and then we eat it. This is also in the 94th Psalm. So there's a bunch of this. Okay, let's go back to 45. I broke down 45 so you can kind of see the parts. So here it is. If you read the Psalm 45 and you don't read it in this context, it doesn't make as much sense. So what I'm trying to do is package this story here. Does that make sense? So we're packaging the story of the temple drama with the 45th Psalm, and we're seeing it as the narrator is going to speak in verses 1 through 2. Elohim is going to bless the prince. Then the prince is going to address Elohim. Then the prince is going to address Jehovah. So there's two gods here. Then the narrator is going to call attention to the women's side of the stage. Then the mother is going to bless the daughter. Then the narrator is going to form the women to cross to Elohim's throne, and then Elohim is going to bless the premortal king and queen. And everybody's seeing this. And this is one way to read the Psalms. And to me, it just makes sense when we read it. So does anybody have the feeling that you're good to read all 17 verses, or should we just break it up? Maybe we break it up into pieces. So we'll do like four each. I'll start, and we'll just go in a circle. Verse 1. My heart is inditing a good matter. So this is the narrator speaking. I speak of the things which I have made touching the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. Thou art fairer than the children of men. Grace is poured into thy lips. Therefore God has blessed thee forever. So now God's going to speak to the prince. Verse 3. Gird thy sword upon thy thigh, O most mighty, with thy glory and thy majesty. In thy majesty ride prosperously because of truth and meekness and righteousness. And thy right hand shall teach thee terrible things. Okay, verse 5 is the conclusion of God speaking to the prince. And then 6 is him addressing God. Go ahead.
Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of thy kingdom is the right scepter. Thou lovest righteousness and hatest wickedness. Wherefore God, thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. All the garments smell of myrrh and aloes and cassia out of the ivory places whereby they have made thee glad. King's daughters are among the honorable women. Upon their right hand did stand the queen in gold above her.
So now the mother is going to bless the daughter in verse 10.
Hearken, O daughter, and consider and incline thine ear. Forget also thy own people and thy father's house. So shall the king greatly desire thy beauty, proclaim thy word, and worship thou him. And the daughter of Tyr shall be there with a gift, even the rich among the people shall entreat thy favor. The king's daughter is all glorious within. Her clothing is of wrought gold. She shall be brought unto the king in raiment of needlework. The virgins, her companions that follow her, shall be brought unto thee.
And then 15.
With gladness and rejoicing shall they be brought. They shall enter into the king's palace. Instead of thy fathers shall be thy children, Yahweh's, make princes in all the earth. I will make thy name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore shall the people praise thee forever.
That last verse is the key to kind of unlocking all this stuff. So notice what it says. This is God speaking to the king and queen. And by the way, if you remember, the king and queen are right here and they represent us. So what's God going to do to them? I'm going to make thy name to be remembered in all generations and the people will praise you. In other words, what that means is if your name is made great, you have seed. And if people praise you, you become kings. So in the Exodus narrative, God's going to tell Moses, I'm going to make you, all of you, collectively, a nation of kings and queens. That's what's happening. Now, if you've been to the temple, like that's happening in the temple.
So I just wanted to clarify something. So in verse 10, is it the divine woman is talking to the women in the crowd?
I think this can be read multiple ways. So in one sense, this is how I read it. I read it as this divine mother is speaking to this mother. In other words, she's speaking to all of us. Now, that's not everybody's reading, but that's how I read it.
So then what's going on in verse 11? I just think that's a little weird.
Oh, okay. So what I have in verse 11 is that the mother's husband, so there's a couple ways to read this too. So LeGrand Baker reads it differently. He reads it like this, that the mother's husband desires her beauty. Now, I know that sounds kind of weird, and there's lots of ways to read this, but one way to read it is that he looks at her and says, your beauty is great. Not like the creepy Joe, you know, version of desire, but like, you know, the old creeper, but your beauty is great.
Sorry, are we talking about the earthly king or the heavenly king? Like, which one are
you? You can read it, like I said, you can read it so many ways. I don't have an answer. So this is how I read it. I don't look at verse 11 as creepy, but I read it as the father, okay, verse 11, the king desires her beauty in the sense of he honors it, not that he desires it. But that's how I read it. But you're right. It can be read. Scripture can be rested a lot of different ways. Now, some people might say, hey, Mike Day, you're resting Psalm 45. That's not what it says. To me, once I see some of the liturgical background to the Psalms and how they're rooted in temple theology, once I see it, I can't unsee it. And I share it with you. I know we've gone on like this 10-minute dirt road, but I share it with you so that you can see that Exodus 15 is part of this. Exodus 15 is this group of slaves that become liberated are made kings and queens. If we go to Exodus 19, in fact, let's go there really quick. They're made kings and queens by God in this setting. And so if we understand that and we see that and we see the feast, like let me just take you to a couple things really quick. Look at verse 5.
Sorry, is this 19?
Yeah, 19:5. First, I'm going to take you out on eagle's wings in verse 4. And then it says, if you obey my voice, verse 5, I'm going to make my covenant with you and you're going to be peculiar above all other people. So this is like the end of Psalm 45. You're going to be above all. I'm going to praise you. I'm going to give you a name. And then look in verse 6. Ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now my Mike Day Midrash is going to be, you shall be a kingdom of kings and queens, priests and priestesses. Unto the Most High God. That's Exodus 19:6. Now, like I said, I did my Mike Day Midrash. I did my, what I call my Mike Day Joseph Smith translation, where I add some things to there. Then look at the feast. Go to the 24th chapter. The feast was on the eighth day. Well, in Exodus 24, look what happens. Nine, 10, and 11. Let's read that for us. Exodus 24, 9, 10, and 11.
They went to Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a pavework of a sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel, who laid not his hand, also they saw God, and did eat and drink.
Okay. There's the feast. Now, it doesn't say it in there, but my take is Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel are washed and anointed, clothed, and they have a feast. And because it's a male-centric text, we skip the women. There is no feast without the women. It doesn't exist. So I put that in there. That's me. But I know what the text says. Okay? Grace Emerson, she wrote this. She's a Bible scholar. She says, it is commonplace to remark that male members only of the community were required to attend the three major annual festivals, according to Exodus 23, and you might add this one too, 24. But difference of obligation does not necessarily imply inequality, and in this case probably arose from practical considerations attendant on the birth and care for children. Certainly, Deuteronomy makes it clear that women were present at the festivals, sharing in the rejoicing. I might add, with Emerson, we just read Psalm 45. If it is a temple liturgical text, that's the women's part. If you read Exodus 15, at least from verse 20, we have women doing the same stuff. And then you couple with Psalm 68, where it says there were women doing singing, dancing with timbrels, and they're singing about the victory of God at Sinai, killing Egypt. We just read all that stuff, right? So you see how I'm packaging Psalm 68, Exodus 15, Psalm 45, and then just for good measure, I threw Psalm 74 at you. We're throwing all this stuff out, and I'm putting it all in the stew, okay? So it's clear that women were present at the festivals. To me, it's clear. Sharing in the rejoicing, participating in the sacrifices, the Feast of Weeks and Booths are specifically mentioned, if you go to Deuteronomy, as feasts that involve the women. And then she writes, this may well represent an advance on earlier law in the direction of equality, a feature which seems to be characteristic of Deuteronomy. There's some good things in Deuteronomy, she says. This book presents women as participants in the covenant ceremony and consequently under full obligation to observe Yahweh's laws. Equally with the men, they could have been held guilty of transgression of the covenant just like the men, for which the penalty was death. The evidence suggests that it was the Deuteronomistic law which first explicitly brought them within the covenant. The view that women are fully accountable before Yahweh continues into the post-exilic period. So while I do have some issues with Deuteronomy, at least with their theology of God and visions and mysteries and so forth, there's a lot of stuff in there, especially about equality, that makes sense. So it's kind of a mixed bag. But Emerson's point is, clearly women were involved. Okay? There's Psalm 74, which we kind of read. Drying up the rivers, dividing the sea, killing the dragon. Okay? Anyway, what does this have to do with you? Well, I think what it has to do with you is to, if we read the Old Testament as it was used in this kind of context, we can see it differently. And we can see that we're participants in this. I also like it because, especially, it's been stripped so much of like women's roles that Exodus 15, especially as one of these older texts, shows that Miriam kind of played this really cool role. And what do we know about that, you know? I don't know. There's so many different ways to look at it. But I just wanted to kind of introduce that to you for a few minutes today. Any questions about that? We kind of covered a lot of stuff. We kind of went a lot of places, so thanks for going there with me.
mentioned that a few times. Like, why is that significant, I guess? I'm trying to figure out what exactly.
Music was rooted in the temple.
Okay.
And it was part of the drama. My contention is, and you've heard me say this before, is that every drama that you see that's really good, if it really is good, it's talking about some of these ideas. Life and death and conflict. And if you think about some of the best movies that you really like, some of the most moving points of the movie, a lot of times it is involving music. That's why, at least for me, a lot of times those musical scores, I'll buy the score after the movie and I'll listen to it while I study, especially like the instrumental stuff, because it's just so powerful. A lot of that, in my opinion, has been lost to us. Even with the temple restoration, and we have good music in the temple, we've packaged it differently. We've taken an 8-day experience and we've packaged it into a really small, concentrated thing, and we've also separated some of the elements of the temple out. For example, the feast we don't do in the temple anymore, but we practice it every Sunday. This idea of a communal feast. We have communion.
Oh, I was just looking at 15 verse 20 Exodus, that footnote B. And I guess, I don't know, my question is here, like, there are, like, prophetesses are mentioned a few times in the Old Testament, but it always seems kind of glossed over. We never, ever talk about it as if, like, somehow it's taboo that a woman can receive revelation.
Yeah.
But I'm just kind of interested on more, what does it mean? I mean, anciently, what was kind of the role of a prophetess? Were they really even common, or what do they even mean by the word prophetess? Or
so, literally, is one who is a spokesperson. So, you guys all know this, right? Amos 3:7, finish it with me. Surely the Lord God will do nothing. Yeah, have we talked about that word secret? Okay, so the secret's tied into this liturgically. Secret is the word sod. That's what it looks like. Such an interesting word. Sod. It's spelled in English like that, sod, but it's sod. And the word secret literally means, the word sod literally means the divine counsel. So the word for a prophet, and the conception I want to put into your minds is this. There's a prophet on the earth, and the reason why he's a spokesman or a prophet isn't because anything is put in his mind necessarily, that he's read or whatever, but that he's been brought up into this council where we have the gods. Now, there's always three, especially in these texts. There's the Father, the Mother, and the Son, but then there's a bunch of divinities. And in 1 Nephi 1, it says that they are organized in a numberless concourse. It says concourses. And what's a concourse? One meaning of the word is a circle. So just go with me here. We're back to this. We're back to this sacred space, and there's divine beings in a circle. 1 Nephi 1, right? And so they're brought up into the sod, into the council, and they hear, they deliberate. Like these gods, these divinities deliberate, and then they give, usually they give something to the Navi. They say, here is a text. Go down and read it. Just for fun, go to 1 Nephi 1. Just look what it says really quick. We'll just read a couple verses. Let's see. Joseph doesn't know any of this stuff, right? He's 22. Like, this is Jedi level text. So Lehi, verse 5, is praying to the Lord. Verse 6, a pillar of fire comes and dwells or sits upon the rock, and it quakes. And then his second vision is kind of a repeat, right? He goes home in verse 7. He's overcome. He's carried away. Look at verse 8. He sees the heavens open, and he sees God on his throne. Now, it doesn't say, it just says God. I'm going to say that's El Elyon. I'm going to say that's the Father. What's around him? He's surrounded by numberless concourses of divinities, angels, singing and praising God. But then what does he see in verse 9? Now, he doesn't tell you who it is. I'm going to take that as Yahweh, Jesus. Comes down, and then verse 10, 12 others. In other words, I'm packaging this as he's brought into the council. So they give him a decision. Look at the end of verse 11. What do they give him? They give him a book. Here's the decision of the council. And then verse 13. He reads it and he takes it to the inhabitants. So that seems to, that's a classic Old Testament text of here's what prophets are and here's what prophets do. At least to the mindset of somebody who lived in 600 BC. So now your question, that's kind of a two-part question. What is a prophet? What do they do? Then your next question is, well, what about the sisters? Now, Miriam is playing this role. She's acting prophetic. She's acting as one who's been in the council. She's acting as one who says, God has smote Leviathan, he's cast away the sea, and she's playing this role in this. My contention is this, and I don't know the answer, but I think in the book of Revelation we read that the spirit of prophecy is a testimony of Jesus. And Joseph Smith repackaged that and he said, I would that everybody would be a prophet. And somebody said to Joseph, well, what do you mean? And he said, if you have the testimony of Jesus and you get revelation, you are a prophet. We all need to be a prophet. Then later, Moses is going to say that. He says, I wish all in Israel were prophets. And so there's big, and we've packaged this today in 2020, right? And when we say the prophet, we usually have a big capital P, but I think there's a lowercase p. This is what I think God wants everybody to be. This, in today's society, it's like there can be only one. Yes.
I think that's like the difference as well. Because like we can all be prophets in our own lives. And receiving revelation for ourselves and what we're going through for our families and stuff. But to receive revelation for the church, that's can only be right one.
You got it.
I guess like one thing that just I was just confused about that footnote from 20 that took me to to Judges, is that it talks about Deborah, who was a prophetess, and says she judged Israel at that time.
Yes.
I was under the impression that, you know, judgment of Israel was solely a male priesthood responsibility. So I don't know what the text means by that.
Yeah, so here's what it means. The judges in Judges are not judges. And that's welcome to the Old Testament. It's just messed up. So the judges are kind of like, I'm trying to think of even what is a really good word. In a lot of the Akkadian texts, they have a word for it. I can't remember what it is, but it means big man. In other words, the big man, the person in charge. So Deborah, because of her prowess, because of who she is, her charisma or her spiritual gifts, she's in charge. Now we got to parse this out, right? This is difficult. There's kingdom. And then there's church. What do I mean by that? First, kingdom. We're going to wrap this up in like 5 minutes, I promise, Sarah. We've got kingdom, like the kingdom of God. But then we have kingdom, the kingdom of Bailey. What's your kingdom? Your family. So when you go to the temple and you kneel at the altar, you're given the promise of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they're promised kingdoms, thrones. All this stuff. So you have the right to receive revelation for your kingdom. To me, I package that when you're a grandma and you have 17 grandkids, I believe, I can't prove it, but I believe that you have the right for revelation for that grandchild. And you can call that grandchild up and say, I had a dream about you. You might want to listen to what I have to tell you. You're a prophetess and a judge of your kingdom. Then there's kingdom of God. We're back to this big P. There has to be somebody in charge, right? If there's nobody in charge, who do we blame it on, right? That's why some religions are very difficult, not to throw them under the bus, but Islam is so problematic because there's nobody in charge. We can't point to that guy and say, he's the one in charge. But if Catholics start blowing stuff up, who do we get mad at? The Pope. If Mormon missionaries get AK-47s and they go rogue, we call President Nelson. But what do you do with Islam? Because there's nobody in charge. And my contention is there has to be somebody in charge. Who does Pharaoh deal with? Moses, right? Why? He's kind of in charge. And that's kind of the pattern that we start seeing. That's big K. This is little K. And then we get into church. And that's another lesson. Like, what do you even do with the word church? And how does that shake out? It still kind of follows some of the same things. I hope that helps. I hope that's not confusing. But you're right. Deborah is not a... She doesn't walk around with a gavel and say, well, you have to do 2 years of community service. She's not Judge Wapner. or Judge Judy. I don't know if that helps. Okay, are we good? Any other questions, comments about any of this stuff? Okay, well, 2 minutes left. Let's just look at this. We'll just end here. 17. Awesome. I hope that wasn't too big of a dirt road, but I just wanted to make sure that we got that. We'll do manna next time. Let's end here. So verse 8. They're trying to get through some land, and it says Amalek fought them in Rephidim. And verse 9 says, in chapter 17, Moses said to Joshua, choose men and go and fight them. And I'll stand on the top of the hill with the rod in my hand. So that's what you see. You see Moses here. I love this picture. He's got the rod in his hand. And then it says, Joshua, verse 10, did as Moses has said, and he fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. And it came to pass when Moses raised up his hand that Israel prevailed. But when he let it down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. So we're pinning on that word heavy again. And they took a stone and they put it under him and he sat on it. So here he's sitting on the stone. And Aaron and Hur stayed by his hands, one on the one and one on the other, and his hands were steady till the going down of the sun, and Joshua discomfited Amalek. And so this is the story of how they were able to get through Amalek territory by him holding up the staff. And it's like the editor leaves this to you without comment and just shows you this image and then leaves it up to you to interpret it. So with the last minute in class, and as you see this image, what does it prompt you to think about, and what message does it give you? What does that communicate? Yeah.
And so there's those, I love that there's two people holding him up. Takes a couple to keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
What's the rod symbolic of here?
This is symbolic of kingship. So when Nephi says we grabbed the iron rod and it took us to the tree, my contention is the tree is in the Holy of Holies. The throne is in the Holy of Holies. And so God's sitting on his throne by the tree and the river, and he's holding out a rod. Now, this is dream imagery, so the rod goes forever. It's not a railing. In all of our paintings, we make it into a railing, but he's holding the rod. So Moses is holding up the symbol of God, the kingship. Anciently, the rod was considered broken from the tree of life. It was snapped. It's like magical, right? And he's holding it up. And by the way, this right here, what you see, this in Old Testament is the stature of prayer. It's either this or it's this. This is how they would pray. Now, think about this. If I came to you anciently and I came to you like this, what do you know about me? I'm not armed, right? If I'm a stranger and I come to you, and by the way, we see this. This is the symbol in military matters for what? Surrender. Don't shoot. I'm not armed. So this is a symbol of vulnerability. This is God. You're praying to God. I'm not armed, but also bless me. So Moses is praying to God, but he's holding the symbol for kingship. But his arms get tired. So there's a lot going on in this text. This is also a beautiful text about human connectivity. I can't do it anymore. Well, you need somebody, right? Modern prophets have used this to say, please hold up my arms. If somebody denigrates me or the church, let's support each other. There's so much in the temple. We say things like, don't say bad things about the Lord's kids. Right? In other words, there's like 19 ways to slice this, and it's beautiful, and the author just drops the symbol and says nothing. And that's what the Old Testament does. And so sometimes I just like to just show it. Like that's why I can't teach Old Testament without visuals, because I'm like, it's all visual. So I just leave my testimony with you that this message to me, especially during COVID, is so relevant. Let us support each other. Let us love each other. And it's also a symbol for patience. Like, let us be patient with each other.